Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, Sean Clayton.
Welcome to Schooled with a Professor, and we're going to talk some defense today. We're going to talk about some of the changes over the years, some of the great defenses, and joining us right now, a first-time Hall of Fame eligible, which is Rondé Barber. And Rondé, first off, congratulations on, you know, making the 25, and best of luck, because I'll be sitting in the room. We have the vote coming down from to 15. Best of luck to you.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it, man. It's 27, right? I got a couple other
27.
Ties in there, right?
So uh-huh.
It makes it even tougher on me.
We've had that the last couple of years. It's kind of weird because, you know, normally it's going to be 25, but then we've had a couple extras. So it's like, and hey, listen, and one of the things I know, because I've been doing the voting in the Hall of Fame since 1988. I mean, it is,
wow.
You know, it's, if you make the 15, and sometimes, I mean, you, and this is such a stacked class because, again, with 6 first-time eligibles and 4 new first-time eligibles.
Yep.
I mean, this one is going to be really tough because, again, when you bring in so many quality guys for the first time around, It becomes, over time, everybody gets in.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I remember when I retired with Urlacher and Ray Lewis and Hutchinson, and we all decided to quit. Randy Moss, we all decided to quit the same year. I was like, down the road, a bunch of my friends were saying, yeah, good decision. You probably should have waited another year.
Well, it's probably like last year, because, I mean, you look at all the guys that retired in 2016 with Peyton Manning and that whole group.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yep. You know, there's some years like that. And, you know, we actually, you know, look ahead to say, uh-oh, we better get this guy in, because, like, for example,
yeah.
I mean, you look at the safeties, and, you know, you got John Lynch, who you know so well,
yep.
And you got Steve Atwater. But it's like, once you start getting Ed Reed and Troy Polamalu into the mix, then it becomes, uh-oh, we better get these guys in,
yep.
Fast.
For sure, Brian Dawkins, those types. You got a bunch of names. I think the reality of it is, John, you can probably attest to this as much as I can, just having played, just the quality of play has gone up, and the number of superstars that have emerged over the past, I don't know, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
Is way more than it was, you know, back in the day. And I think the visibility of the game, obviously the popularity, the continued popularity of it, allows more of these names to kind of define themselves. And so their numbers get more recognized, the popularity vote, the Pro Bowl, and all the other stuff. So it's only going to get tougher. You're exactly right.
Well, and then also stats have helped out, because, I mean, years
yeah.
ago we didn't have the ability to go in and say, okay, you're looking at the, quote, burned defenders. But, of course, what you look at is the positive side. Like, for example, you look at Richard Sherman. I mean, he, and even Deion Sanders and guys like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you compare the stats, I mean, when you don't get thrown on, then it's like you bring that out, and that
yeah.
really gives better recognition to the player. And so you start to see those numbers, and it translates into making that player at least be acknowledged for how good he really is.
Yeah, I think that's the hard thing, too, with guys like that, especially guys like Rich, because and Patrick Peterson's another one. He's a younger guy, but you know, I had a game with him a couple of weeks ago, and you're looking at the number of targets, and it's by far the least in the league. And so he doesn't get as many opportunities, and that's why it's difficult to balance one player versus a number career-wise, because you just don't get the same number of opportunities. So I totally agree with you, John. It makes it tougher for you guys. You guys got the hard job. We got the easy job. We just got to go play. You guys have to do all the hard stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. We don't get too many injuries, although sometimes it can get a little verbal in the room. But
I can imagine.
It never becomes as bad as, like, Michael Crabtree against Aqib Talib, because, again, our mission is to get guys in. That's the great part.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Hey, now, of course, before we get into talking some defense and all that stuff, how are you enjoying doing the Fox games?
I'm liking it. You know, it keeps me connected. I knew when I retired after the 2012 season I was going to do something. I didn't know exactly what it was. And they approached me, actually, and asked if I would be interested. And I did a test game my last year in the league, and I enjoyed doing it. And, you know, I got 9 games my first year, realized that I liked that better than doing studio work. And then, you know, for the last four years, I've been full game 17 schedule with these guys and just having a great time. I changed crews this year. So I'm working with Kenny Albert, who I'd never worked with before, which is fantastic. And having a great time. I like watching film. You know, I like breaking down players. I like evaluating players, you know, just really translating it back to my playing days. And it's fun, man. It gives me an opportunity to stay involved in a game and continue to watch the game and really give as much input as I can into it, the best I can.
Well, one of the things that you were so good at being in that cover two defense that you had down in Tampa Bay, and I wanted to really get into that, kind of talking about the evolution, the changes in that cover two. I mean, first off, what makes that cover two defense so good, particularly the one that you played with the Bucks?
Well, you need two seam droppers. So that would be me and Derek Brooks. But with the definition of what made it different than regular two is your middle linebacker. So you got to have a middle linebacker that can run through the middle of the field. And at first that was Hardy Nickerson when I was first there, because he was just a bigger athletic guy. Then it was Shelton Quarles. He just had a number of guys that have done it since then. But that was the number one prerequisite, you know, a middle linebacker that could run through the middle of the field and basically cover the deep third. So when you look at defenses now, the way they've evolved, the Seattle 3, it's essentially the same coverage. You have a middle defender, you have two outside defenders, which are the corners, and you have four underneath. Structurally, it's the same. It all depends on what you're doing up front, and that's what made us successful. I mean, we could play those soft zones underneath, keep everything in front of us because we had pass rushers. We had Warren Sapp, we had Simeon Rice, we had Greg Spires on the other end. You look at Seattle and why they're successful at it is because they have pass rushers. They have Michael Bennett, you know, Cliff Averill when he was healthy, now Frank Clark. It's all predicated by what you're able to do in one-on-one situations up front, so you can play that kind of coverage on the back end and not have to put yourself in a situation where you're going to expose your players. You know, Richard Sherman gets the playoff and read the quarterback and get a lot of interceptions because he doesn't have to play on the line of scrimmage and take away now passes. And you know, it's essentially the same thing we did for, you know, a decade and a half or whatever in Tampa.
But at times it was so stifling because, I mean, you see the quarterback rating, you know, it's maybe not the QBR that ESPN's using, but the quarterback rating of those quarterbacks were usually in the, you know, 50s, 60s. I mean, because it was hard to really generate a good passing offense against a stifling cover two defense.
Well, what you wanted to do, what you had to do was really stop the run on first down. If you got them in a negative play on first down, you knew they were behind the sticks. They were going to chase 6 or 7 yards to make a manageable third down. And so once you get in that situation, you're forcing your will on the offense, right? And so you hear people talk about it now, we got to stop the run. Well, if you don't stop the run, you don't get to play these type of defense. You don't get a defense named after you, really. But we were good in understanding what the strengths and weaknesses, what our defense were. And we called it Tampa 2, but reality of it is on first down, we were playing 3 deep in man. You know, we were daring you to throw the football. But, you know, most teams, and the offenses have definitely evolved since then, but most teams back then, they were going to try to run the ball on you on first down and second down and, you know, then throw it. But if you stop it on first and second down, you had your chance to play Tampa 2. And we were good at that and got to play a lot of Tampa 2.
Now, one of the things that you were so good at doing was blitzing from the Tampa 2. I mean, that was one of the specialties. And so how did that evolve and how good did you feel doing that?
Yeah, so back before we started doing it, nickel corners came on the field just to play pass coverage. Through Monty and Lovey and Herm and then Mike T and Joe Barry, we kind of evolved that defense, that nickel back, to be like another linebacker. So I mean, I had run rules and I had fit rules and stuff that nobody else was doing before that. And off of that, we could play nickel on first and second down and not have to just trot the third corner out there on third down. So it really became like a full-time position. And so when we wanted to pressure, you know, we could go weak and blitz the Will linebacker, the free safety, or we could blitz strong, which was me. And I just never saw a lot of guys doing it before then, and then we just got creative. We had so many different entries into the line of scrimmage, whether it was off the edge in a run blitz or whether it was inserting inside the defensive end or even inside the defensive tackle on some occasions. And I knew that they weren't expecting me. And so if you go back and look at the stats when I first started playing in there, I think at one point, I can't remember what year it was, maybe it had been 99, through like three or four games, I was leading the league in sacks. And then, of course, people start catching up. They start realizing, hey, the nickel's going to be a hot guy. We have to point him out. And it gets harder and harder. But I always felt that if I got a one-on-one situation, whether it was a lineman or a back coming across the formation, that I was going to beat him. And a lot of times I did. Just get my opportunities on the quarterback, just have to cash in on them. It became a niche thing for me. You know, I started to really like doing that almost as much as playing coverage. I was always searching for those opportunities, and Monty and them gave me a bunch of shots at it.
One of the things I know from Monty Kiffin, also Tony Dungy and the whole group, is that one of the all keys is you need a linebacker, an outside linebacker or a linebacker that can get 5 sacks, 5 forced fumbles. And Derek Brooks was just so sensational in doing that.
He's the best. Yeah, he was the best. He was unbelievable. He was so smart. I mean, athletically, he was what he was. And at the time, I think when he came out, people thought he was undersized, he was small, but he fit perfectly into what they were looking for. A guy that could play in space. If the ball got checked down to the back, he was going to make the tackle. Playing above the neck is what separated, I think, Derek from any of his peers. I mean, because there was guys who were bigger, more athletic, faster, whatever. But the way he anticipated the game was unlike anything I ever saw when I got to Tampa. And to be honest with you, when I started playing in the nickel, it was almost mirror roles. I mean, he was over the tight end most of the time, but I was over the slot receiver. But I had to have the same reads and the same understanding of the pass game and the run game. And a lot of the stuff I did, I modeled it after him. And I realized if I could do that and still handle my coverage responsibilities, I was going to make a bunch of plays, and I did.
Do you have an adjustable rate mortgage that is about to increase, or first and second mortgage that you would like to combine into one? Low mortgage payment? Hey, give Keel Mortgage a call today. They are local, friendly, and have been serving families up and down the West Coast for over 3 decades. With interest rates forecasted to rise, the best time to explore your options is now. It starts with a phone call to 1-888-778-KIEL or online at keelmortgage.com. That's Keel Mortgage, 888-778-KIEL. They can help. CL53969. Over about a 3-4-5 year period, I would catch a bunch of Chicago, New Orleans games, Chicago Bears, when Chicago was in the cover too. And I watched how the Saints were able to gradually find ways to beat the cover too. Started out to get Jimmy Graham. Okay, so now they got Jimmy Graham. You know, they'd have a 6 route to the outside. They'd have as an option, but they want Jimmy Graham running the seam. Then it got even better when they were able to get a running back that was able to start catching the ball, which they did. And so all of a sudden, you know, what used to be a quarterback rating of Drew Brees would be in the 50s started to go into 80s because there were now ways if you could design your offense to beat the cover two.
Yeah, there's a lot of two beaters out there, just like there's a lot of three deep beaters now. And the Saints were probably the best at figuring out what you were doing and putting you in stressful situations. Now, you get that guy running through the middle of the field, whether it was Joe Horn at one point, if you remember that name, for the Saints playing in the slot, or evolved into a Jimmy Graham. So you're stressing the seam players. You know, that would be the Will linebacker and the nickel. If you stress those guys and get them to get more depth in their coverage because the ball can go over their heads and make big plays in the seam, then you can throw that check down to whatever back, the dynamic back out of the backfield, and he's catching it with 6-7 yards of space, and all he has to do is turn up field, and he's got 10-11 yards. You know, who really figured it out first was St. Louis. St. Louis with Marshall Faulk, those guys, I remember playing them. They would stress you so much through the seam with all those receivers that they had, that Marshall Faulk had so much room when he caught the ball out of the backfield or over top of the ball, and it's why he was so dynamic. I mean, not taking anything away from him being a dynamic player, and his ability was great, but because he had so much room with all that other talent around him, and he just gashed people. And in the open field, he was tough to deal with, and they were our biggest challenge. And that evolved into the Saints and Sean Payton and really figuring out how to beat cover two. And it's gotten a lot of people out of playing a lot of two because of what they were able to do to it.
So where do you say the state of cover two is right now currently in the National Football League?
It's like it shows up. You know, there's a bunch of old school coordinators still around, Greg Williams, Spagnuolo, those guys that were that saw the evolution of it. They use it intermittently, and really it's when it's third and long situations. And the league has turned into a three deep and quarters coverage team. And you know, if you have the athletes, you play man to man. But quarters is so prevalent now, and you're seeing now. I mean, you'll see guys running from the outside, wide open in the middle of the field, and you're wondering how is that guy so wide open? It's usually because they're playing cover four, and the safety gets drawn up by a number two receiver or something, and the corner's out there all by himself, and all of a sudden it's a 60-70 yard pass completion. You know how that happens because it's quarters. Same thing in thirds. The seams are really exposed in thirds coverage. So in third and longs and whatever else, you know, that's about the only time you see cover two anymore. Because the athletes on the outside are so much better, and they have to be to deal with, you know, the giant fast receivers that have proliferated the league now.
So what do you see of, like, Seattle's cover one, cover three type of defense?
Yeah.
Is that kind of the model of what teams are doing now?
That's the model, yeah. And it's really an under front, so you put a linebacker on the line of scrimmage, so it looks like a 3-4, you know, if you're saying what's the shape of it. It looks like you have a 3-4 defense. You have three interior linemen, you have one standing up, and you have a defensive end, a strong end. So you play under up front, you have two stack linebackers, and then in the back end, you have to have guys that understand the rotation, right? You got to understand the weak rotation away from the strong safety, whoever that is, Cam Chancellor in their defense, and then you have to have corners that can play with vision on the outside and see the quarterback throw the football and be able to transition, and they've had that for years. I mean, I think they're kind of, you know, with some of the injuries, it's losing some of its luster. But the structure is the same. You know, look at Atlanta. Look what they do. They've kind of evolved it. The corners play on the line of scrimmage a lot, but it's the exact same defense. Oakland does it. There's a bunch of iterations of it across the league, and some people do it differently. But if there was a copycat, it's a copycat league, right? When we were popular playing cover two, everybody wanted to play cover two. Find me, get the guys that can play cover two. Now, really in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe even 10 years now, you're looking for those big, long corners that can play outside, cover up wide receivers, and then those underneath guys that can play in that four underneath zone and make a lot of football plays, and you understand what you're doing. You can fly around and make a ton of plays, and that's what they do well, or it's what they have done well for so many years.
Well, the interesting transition they're going through right now, obviously with Richard Sherman out and Cam Chancellor out, wondering about his career, is they still were able to get lucky enough to land a couple guys. Like, for example, they trade Jeremy Lane. He fails the physical in Houston, and he drops back, and he's been playing in this defense since 2012.
Yep.
And then they get lucky for timing because Byron Maxwell was available. And, of course, you know, he earned a $10.5 million contract playing cover one, cover three, going to Philly. And then next thing you know, he's not playing cover one, cover three. They had him playing off coverage, and now he gets back here, and within 3 days, three practices, he goes out, gets a chance to get back on the field, and he's done great.
Yeah, he has, and that's, of course, because Shaquille Griffin, who I think is going to be a dang good player, John, because he got hurt. So, yeah, they you have to find the body type. And I mean, a little guy like me would have trouble playing that defense just because of the way that they have to cover up receivers down the football field. You need a longer guy, and they've got. I mean, fortunate for them with Richard Sherman out, they've got three guys that can do it.
Well, there's one guy that they've added this year that really kind of minimized the damage when they would have Earl Thomas out, because last year Earl Thomas missed the last four games.
Yeah.
The defense gave up 284 yards a game passing, but they brought in Bradley McDougal, who has 36 starts in Tampa Bay, and he's done a pretty good job of kind of minimizing any time when Chancellor is out or any type of time when Earl Thomas is out.
Yeah. You're exactly right, and I'm very familiar with Bradley because he was here, and he was, you know, kind of deemed surplus here when they drafted a couple of guys and brought back some other free agents. You can't pay them all, right? It's just the nature of the business. But when you need depth, having a guy like Bradley that can play both, he can play strong safety for Cam, he can play free safety for Earl when he was out. Those guys are invaluable. I mean, they're hard to find. But you know, when you need depth, having a veteran guy like that is huge. It's hugely beneficial.
Yeah. What do you think the next trend is going to be?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I look for it across the league, and you end up seeing the same thing from teams trying to be Seattle, whatever's hot. I think back in the day, in the late 80s, early 90s, teams were wanting to play a lot of man-to-man, put you guy on the line of scrimmage. My guy's better than your guy. But then the evolution of the passing offense kind of made that undesirable because teams were giving up too many big plays. There's not many different formation or different coverages that you can play. I mean, essentially you have two, you have four, you have one, and you have three, and you have three deep. Other than that, I mean, on the back end, there's nothing you can do. I mean, you can play these combination coverages and, you know, some things that are unsound, you know, where your corners are sitting in the flat after looking like they're playing three deep and jumping stuff. But that's not sound. You know, the sound defenses, there's only about four of them. And I don't think many defensive coordinators around the league are willing to do unsound stuff for too long. And then you end up being like New Orleans, who, when I put the film on back, you know, during the Ryan days, you're like, what are they trying to run here? I have no idea what this is. And you wonder why they're getting beat. I think it'll always stay around what it is. You'll see a lot of four now. You'll see a lot of three. You'll see some two, and you'll see one. I think other than that, you can change the fronts in different games and blitz packages, but for the most part, I think all the coverages will stay the same.
Yeah, and of course, that's the fun part. Now, just briefly, what would be the cover three, cover one beaters? What type of plays? And you mentioned a little bit of the seam stuff. What works against the cover one, cover three?
So you think cover three. You think cover three. It's three deep, four underneath, right? So the plays that beat you are the ones through the seam. So over the nickel, over the strong safety away from the nickel. You know, the passes that curl in behind because it's in front of the free safety, the guy in the middle of the hole, and over top of those guys. It's essentially, if you can get your underneath guys to slow their feet down enough, from an offensive perspective, the ball can go through there. So if number two's running through the seam, straight through the seam, he's got a receiver outside, a number one receiver outside, the number two guy's running through the seam, the corner's in a predicament, right? Because he's got to deal with the outside receiver. He's also got to overlap the underneath defense and make a play on number two. So you see it all the time. And if the corner gets greedy, if his feet slow down or something, the ball's got to go to that number two guy, and you see a lot of plays. Now, there's crossing routes. I mean, the opposite high lows, two guys from either side of the football going across the formation, crossing each other, where you get the underneath guys' eyes to change. But other than that, it's tough. It's tough. It's tough to beat. And obviously, you got to find time up front. I mean, most defenses are expecting the guys up front to get home.
No doubt. Hey, Rondé, it's just great catching up with you and great having that education here about cover one, cover two, cover three, and of course, what you did well, cover anybody.
Yeah, thanks, Chad.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with a Professor.